You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey, y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 133. Today is going to be kind of unusual. This is going to be an interview of me by a previous guest. I've never done it, and I've sort of felt weird about it, but I've gotten a bunch of requests, so we're going to do that. Before we jump in, though, the last episode was a Q&A show, and I had Liz Wood with me, and that was a lot of fun. We had about 15 or 18 questions from listeners like you. So if you haven't listened, go back and give it a listen. Those are always popular and fun shows. Today's episode is brought to you by Liz Wood. Again, she was on the last show, but LizWoodRealty.com. Liz is a terrific realtor who does a great job of kind of breaking down the city and helping people figure out what's the right fit for them. She can help you whether you're looking to rent or buy. And one of the things that I really love about Liz is she really builds a great community of people that she's worked with. So particularly if you're moving to New Orleans, you know, you come, you may not have a community, and Liz helps take care of that. She'll introduce you to people, and she's very outgoing and likes to bring former clients of hers together. She was just talking about the other day having a crawfish boil soon. So when you're ready to purchase the home of your dreams, reach out to Liz at LizWoodRealty.com. I also want to mention Workplace Solutions. So they primarily, before COVID, they specialize in office furniture from Steelcase and others. They have partnerships with Microsoft, and they were really focused on building out office environments that made sense and helped people be productive. They continue to do that, but in a COVID environment, they have also really helped people who maybe have a work-at-home situation and need a better chair or a better desk. They recently helped me a couple months ago get a sit-stand desk, and I have a bad back, and that has made a load of difference at home. So I'll put links to their website in the show notes today, but they are a terrific partner, and whether you're looking to build out an office for hundreds of people or just looking to build out your home office to have a little space away from the family, they can help you with that too. Finally, I want to mention Patreon. If you love the show, love the Facebook group, love what we're doing, for the price of a cup of coffee or beer, you can support me and really make a difference in helping me produce the art that I share with you. So with that, we're going to jump in, but I want to introduce our guest interviewer. He is a cultural, I would say not historian, but a cultural documentarian. He is a chef, he's a wonderful photographer, and he's a previous guest on the podcast. Welcome to the show, Mr. James Cullen. How are you?
Hi, Mark. Thank you. I'm really, I'm doing well. It's a beautiful day in the Crescent City today. It's probably one of those 10 nice days we get a year.
It is. We are at Bracciol, just a block from the river in the Bywater, and it's lovely out here.
It's one of those days where everyone who visits the city like a few times a year thinks, oh, the weather's always so great, I want to move here, and then, you know, July hits, August hits, hurricanes and torrential rains and street flooding, all the good stuff that we have.
But today is not one of those days,
right? Not at all.
It is beautiful. You will hear some things in the background. There's a great outdoor, in fact, most of the Bracciol place is outdoor. There are kids and families playing cornhole next to us. There's some dogs, people enjoying beers like us. We have some nice liters of beer here. But the reason we're doing this today, James was one of the ones that's been, gosh, you've been pushing me forever to do this. And I felt funny about it, but I do get questions like, who are you? And in the Facebook group, lots of people don't know that I have a podcast, and I've been doing this for 5+ years. And I've sort of pushed back on this, but James and others really pushed me to do it. So I'm going to turn this over to you, James, and let you have the show.
Okay, so we're going to jump right in. I want to start with the podcast. So every hero and every villain has an origin story. How did you get started with the podcast? What was the genesis of it?
I was watching national news coverage, maybe CNN, of Mardi Gras Day. And they were showing the typical Bourbon Street, people reaching up for beads from balconies. And you know, it was packed, and there's the usual, I think that day they had actually blacked out some lewdness. And I just thought, I'm tired of that being the image of New Orleans. It's not the image that I think of, and I grew up here, and people raise kids here and have families, and I just got aggravated with it and said, you know, I can do something to try to change that perspective.
Okay, so you're born and raised New Orleanian. Tell me about the neighborhood you grew up in and how it shaped you, your understanding, and your understanding of what you wanted this podcast to be as far as what you wanted to represent about the city or teach people about the city.
So I grew up kind of between Gentilly and Lakeview, maybe three-quarters of a mile from Lake Pontchartrain. Longtime listeners know that my family owned Teddy's Grill, which was a po' boy place. We'll get to that later, I think. You have a question about that. But that really shaped it because I grew up in a neighborhood full of families, and I grew up in a neighborhood where it was generational families. And I saw, and I grew up with that, you know, where people raised families and they did plenty of stuff in the city. And again, it was nothing like the image that people have either of Mardi Gras or the people that come to town and never get off Bourbon Street and just have too much to drink and have hand grenades and huge ass beers. And I grew up in this whole different world in New Orleans. I grew up going to Mardi Gras as a toddler. And now I raise my own kids in the city. And I just, it really influenced me in that way. Family. And then the second way, and I won't go too far into it because I know you have a question about Teddy's Grill, but I grew up in a neighborhood business, and it was a great way to grow up, and you really got to know the people, and that just really affected me, that New Orleans is about people. It's not about the neon signs and the big drinks and all that stuff.
I think you touched upon something really interesting and important there, is that when you go to a place like New York City, you can ride around in a hop-on, hop-off bus, and you can see sites. You see the Empire State Building. You used to see the World Trade Center. You can see the Statue of Liberty. If you ride around in a hop-on, hop-off bus here, I mean, it can't really even get into our most historic neighborhood, the French Quarter. And it doesn't. We don't have those same sites. So really, what I find keeps people coming back to New Orleans and gives New Orleans its animating spirit really is the people. Do you want to talk about the people?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, to your point, I think it's the difference, like in New York, between hop on, hop off, and exploring the boroughs, right? Like really wandering through Brooklyn or something like that. I think, and it's interesting because we have hop on, hop off buses here, and they kind of make me cringe because the way, to me, New Orleans is a lot like Paris. If you've had the opportunity to go, the neighborhoods are very distinct. The way to experience Paris is to walk, to sit in a cafe, to eat from the street vendors. And I think what's interesting about the people in New Orleans is that it's very neighborhood-based. You know that. You live in a neighborhood with a lot of history. I live in a neighborhood with a lot of history. And certainly before Katrina, people didn't leave their neighborhoods.
That was my next question.
And we'll get there. And what that means is a real sense of culture and pride beyond just the city, right? I've lived in places in Texas where there's a lot of pride in being a Texan. But here there's a lot of pride in being from a specific neighborhood. And you see people that really generationally don't go far from that neighborhood. And to me, that's really what it is. You get to know neighborhood characters. There are characters in New Orleans, and we can get into some of that. At the restaurant, it was really characters. We knew everyday people who came in quite a bit, and we got to know them. We knew people like Alan Toussaint and Pat Swilling from the Saints, and people that came in that, you know, Pete Fountain, people that were well known, but they were just people in a sense. And I think that's what makes New Orleans unique. It, like you said, it's not the... Sure, it's neat to see the French Quarter, and there are attractions. But this is why I think that idea of the hop-on, hop-off bus, it's much more about wandering and getting to know people, right? Everyone's got a story. And
I think you touched upon something very interesting there, which is proximity. When I was a chef in New York City, I served Alec Baldwin and Tyra Banks, but I never hung out with them.
Right.
But the proximity to our kind of local celebrity culture, and I mean, you know, there's many nights I've hung out with Kermit Ruffins or Little Freddie King or Big Sam. You know, these are people that I admired and I've been able to build friendships with over the years, and I don't think you have that. There's a, in bigger cities like LA and New York, there's a very sharp dividing line between. Yeah. And here it all kind of blurs. Is that something you think?
You know, yes, that's a great point, because I think, I don't know why that is. I have a hunch that everything originates from Mardi Gras and the sort of community and being in the streets. But you're absolutely right. I also think New Orleanians tend not to be starstruck. So when you see someone famous walk in, or New Orleans famous even, right, people tend to treat them as people. Kermit's a good one, right? Kermit is one of the most well-known, most popular characters in New Orleans. And he's happy to talk to you all day long. But people don't tend to sort of mob him. They may say, hey, Kermit, what's up? Let me buy you a drink, whatever. And that was true of people like Alan Toussaint or Irma Thomas, both whom came in the restaurant. You and I both, I know one of your heroes in New Orleans was Chef Leah Chase. And Chef Chase would come in the restaurant. She was really famous and brilliant. And in a lot of places, somebody like that would sort of get mobbed. And she was just Chef Leah, you know. She would wave to people. People recognized her, but they didn't sort of, I don't know, assault her, for lack of a better, right? The same with Saints players. People see them around town. They say hi, but it just seems a little bit more chill than other cities for whatever reason.
I know the gumbo analogy gets overused. And you know, it's really becomes trite after a while, but I will say there's something about this city which kind of subsumes cultures. You can't find a pure example of Italian food, mm-hmm. or even you go to a Vietnamese restaurant, they have some form of gumbo on the menu. And
right.
There's a kind of a cross melding, mixing. It gives the culture its richness, I think, on some level.
Yeah, I think the gumbo analogy is overused, and at the same time, it, you know, cliches are often true. And I think in the sense of, even going back to the sort of the origin story of New Orleans, right, it was such a cross-section. First of all, there were Native Americans living here. Then you had French, followed by Spanish. The slave trade, as horrible as that was, brought all these cultures together from parts of Africa and then later the West Indies and Saint-Domingue. And I think that, well, not I think, all of those brought their own cultures, their own food, their own crops, their own spices, all of that stuff. And in a sense, Katrina reset that again. So, you know, there's always pushback, and you and I have talked about this, this idea of native New Orleanians and people that weren't born here. And my opinion is, you're a New Orleanian if you live here and you engage yourself in the culture. It also means you bring your own. You're a chef. You came from New York City?
New Jersey, Mark. I cooked in New York City.
Right. You worked in New York. I'm sorry about that. But you brought all of your experiences, and you have become every bit a New Orleanian as someone who's born here.
Thank you.
Because you care about the culture. You engross yourself in the culture. And I think that gumbo idea, again, after Katrina, you had a lot of laborers come from Central America and other parts to help build the city. Many people stayed, and now we have this Latin American focus or influence on our food that essentially didn't exist before.
And it's excellent, too.
It's terrific.
It really is. And this Katrina corollary, I actually wanted to hit upon that. So we both know that before Katrina, there was a lot of people that not only never got out of their neighborhood, they might have never got off their block.
Yes.
I mean, it was very, very hyper-local. How do you think the city's opened up more, and you've learned more about the stories of different people in different neighborhoods that maybe even you didn't know about before?
Sure. Well, first, your point. What's interesting to me about that is you really did have people that were hyper-local, a couple blocks, right? And there was like a bodega or a neighborhood place where they got groceries. There was a corner place where they got po' boys. And what's interesting to me about that is it really crosses socioeconomic levels. So a place like the Treme or the Ninth Ward, people think of that as a lot of people didn't drive, you know, and they didn't leave. But we know a lot of people that grew up in the Garden District that are fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh generations. And even today...
And they'll let you know it.
Yes, they will. I think my mom's a sixth or seventh generation, even though we did not grow up in the Garden District. But those same people, they might be 50 years old, and they still have spent 90% of their lives in one square mile. And so, you know, that brings both some problems in that we don't necessarily always sort of intermingle as much as we should. It also brings this pride. And to your point about Katrina, it upset that apple cart a little bit. Lots of people were displaced. You know, some people never came back, some people did. And then what we saw is a lot of people came to help. Didn't even know really what that meant. Some church groups, some just volunteers. And for the first time, at least in my memory, you had a large influx of people all at once that weren't from here, that just had this altruistic sense of, I want to help. And that also meant the reverse, that people from here needed help. And so maybe we were a little bit more welcoming than we would have been. There were people sort of in different neighborhoods that wouldn't have been in those neighborhoods, from other places who were curious and helpful. And a lot of that has stuck. Now, there's some challenges. There's been some gentrification, certainly. Sometimes sort of cultural appropriation. People come in and they just, whether they know better or not, they're stepping on toes. But as bad as Katrina was, and it was horrible, and obviously several thousand people lost their lives, lots of people lost their livelihoods. But it did, New Orleans was maybe stagnant in a lot of ways. And one of the positive things from Katrina is that there is a lot more diversity, particularly from people outside of New Orleans. And I think that is, if there's a positive thing to come out of Katrina, that's it.
So you've built a really large platform for yourself. Tell me a little bit about the statistics of the podcast. What kind of numbers do you do? And are you surprised that you built it into such a...
Yeah.
Because I had a college professor that I hadn't seen in 25 years that told me she heard me on episode 14. She called me.
See, and you thought no one listened to that show. You've told me that a bunch. You know, when I started it, I did have an eye towards making it more than a hobby. What was interesting is when I started it and I kind of researched it, there were no podcasts about New Orleans, which just shocked me given the popularity of the city. But I thought, you know, maybe I can do this and someday I could get an advertiser, or I wasn't really sure what would happen. The very first month, though, and this is 5.5 years ago, when you still had to explain to people what a podcast was, I got about 700 listeners the first month. And that, I wasn't sure if that was a lot or not. But people said that's a lot in the podcasting world. So now you jump forward 5.5 years. The podcast has been downloaded more than 800,000 times. I have interactions, like you said, all the time. People walk up to me and say, are you Mark Bologna? Which gives my wife no amount of fodder for jokes in the house. People email me or text me. Just the other day, someone said, I didn't know that you had a podcast. I was searching for New Orleans. It's allowed me to meet people from all over the country. So I had no idea. You know, it's turned into, we have some great sponsors. It's turned into some business opportunities. But probably the thing that I underestimated is how many people I met. I probably wouldn't have met you. We knew each other through NOLA Twitter a little bit, which is a whole thing. But I've gotten to meet so many people. And maybe you have a question about this, but it's caused, I've gotten to dig into New Orleans in a way that I didn't know the city. And I would have never guessed that, James. And what I mean by that is, say, plantations. I knew what lots of New Orleanians knew. The antebellum, sort of picturesque, right? Hoop skirts. I obviously knew, at least I thought I knew, a decent amount about slavery. But in digging into it through the podcast, I spent a lot of time at Whitney Plantation, which is the one everyone should go to, you know, focus solely on the lives of the enslaved. And it not only made me really think about that, it made me think about the Garden District. You know, you see the sugar kettles that are used as fountains, and the Garden District is beautiful, and I think people should go to visit it. But I also think they should have the context of, this is built on the back of the enslaved. And I never thought about it in the depth that I do now, for instance. And so the numbers are great. They're growing. Apparently, according to the podcasting experts, whoever they are, I am in the top 0.5% of all podcasts in the world, which is staggering to me when I have this little niche podcast about New Orleans. But I think it's because people love New Orleans, right? And they're happy to talk about it, and they just want to share that love.
So part of your platform, too, is you have a Facebook page.
I knew that was coming.
It's coming. And, well, you have a Twitter account, obviously, but that's more your personal account. But
right.
A lot of people that have kind of discovered your Facebook page, have discovered almost independently from the podcast. And, you know, you have a decent mix, including myself, of people that live here, which, you know, me, people that are from here, you know, and been here a long time, and then people that some have never been here, you know, and how difficult it is balancing those expectations, managing the kind of questions you get, you know, keeping, kind of managing it all.
So James and I were at Dixie Brewery, soon to be Faubourg Brewing, maybe 2 weekends ago, and I was sharing with you. We had gotten a question, so the Facebook group's about 8,000 people, and we had gotten a question that started off with, who are you anyway? And I was really taken aback because I started the Facebook group as a sort of outcrop of the podcast. You know, it was a way to sort of, podcasting is great, but it's one way. So, right, it was a way to be able to say, hey, if you love the podcast, you want to share your stories about New Orleans, join our Facebook group. But over time, as it's grown, the algorithm caught us, and so, you know, people who are searching New Orleans on Facebook will get pointed to the group. And you're right, they'll join. And it's amazing to me, whenever I post, do you know we have a podcast, about 50% of the people don't, and about easily 75% of the people have no idea who I am. They just join this group, and then they're like, who's this guy that's posting all the time? Or when we have to, you know, block somebody or say calm down because of COVID, people don't know who I am. It's been really difficult as it's grown because it started off with this core of people that knew me through the podcast, and now there's lots of people that don't. They don't know about the podcast. You know, I guess what people share there is a love of New Orleans. One of the hard things is, like any group, you get the questions that are easily searchable, you know. So we get a lot of, I'm coming to New Orleans, what should I do? You know, and my instinct is to say I have 132 episodes. You know, there's plenty there, and there's plenty to search in the group.
TripAdvisor.
Right. At the same time, I kind of temper that with people are excited. And if we can be a community where people come and share that excitement, then, you know, that's a good thing.
I tend to think sometimes that locals can be too dismissive. And I try never to do that. I'm happy to talk to the people in Portugal or wherever, you know. They're like, where should I go tonight? You know, I'm like, well, you know, let me see who's playing on Frenchman, you know.
Right.
To give them a good experience, because I think, you know, it's easily, you can have a really bad experience here as easily as you can have a really good experience.
Absolutely.
Here.
You know, Bourbon Street's a perfect example. You can go two blocks off. Either way, really, and have a whole different experience and see a whole different thing and see a neighborhood, right? Or where you and I are sitting. We're sitting at Bratjahl again, which is in the Bywater, which has become very popular. But I venture to say a lot of people listening have never heard of this place. And it's not a New Orleans place, right? You don't come here for New Orleans food. But on a day like this where it's gorgeous, this is a terrific place to be.
It's sublime, really.
It is. You're a block from Crescent Park, which is not only picturesque and gives you a different view of the city. It's a great place to walk. It's a great place to just to be. You know, there's the Rainbow Bridge, which is the Rusty Rainbow, excuse me, which is photographic, photogenic in its own way. And people that come visit aren't going to see this unless they listen to the podcast or they talk to somebody who lives here.
Right. So this is like a more serious question. So having the podcast and having this platform, there's a good deal of responsibility that comes with it. How do you come up with your story ideas, and how do you decide, like, whose stories to tell?
Early on, it was hard because I'm introverted, and so I was really, like, nervous about approaching people. But I had brainstormed ahead of time because somebody somewhere had said to me, if you can't spend 30 minutes and come up with 30 or 40 topics, you shouldn't do a podcast. And I did that, and I had no trouble coming up with very rough topics. These days, I get a lot of feedback. A lot of people will say, you should do this, you should do that. But often, those ideas will go on a list in Evernote, and they'll stew for a long time, sometimes a couple of years, where I know I want to do something, but either I feel like, early on, I feel like I didn't have the chops for it. Then sometimes I'll see an idea and think, I can't I can't figure out the angle that I want because I try, you know, the tagline is an insider's guide to New Orleans. And so I try to do a twist. I don't want to do a story that's been done 50 times in the way it's been done. And probably the best example is the upstairs lounge fire. So that was a fire in the early 70s at a gay bar. A bunch of people died. It was, again, in the context of the early 70s, it wasn't easy to be out. So there was shame associated with this. Some of the people who died, their families didn't want to claim them. I had a personal connection to that because I had an uncle who was gay who lived very close to there. And so it was a topic I wanted to do from the beginning, and I didn't know how to do it. I wanted to be respectful. I couldn't do that one on my own. I had to find the right person. And it sat for almost 4 years. And then through some just random circumstances, someone introduced me to a guy named Bobby Fiesler, who was writing a book about the upstairs lounge fire. And that just seemed like the right spot. And so it was an extremely emotional episode, but it's one that I'm really proud of because we were able to tell this story that a lot of people don't know, and we were able to tell it on a personal level. So he had really researched the men, largely, that were there and what their stories were like. And so that's one. It sat for, I think, 3 years before I did it.
Did you see the NOMA exhibit with that? Because it's interesting that you brought up that particular story only because, and this isn't a question, this is just a statement, but when I was working at St. Mark's Church, during the pandemic, I would cook at St. Mark's Church and we would distribute the food, you know, to the hungry. St. Mark's United Methodist Church on North Rampart and Governor Nichols was one of the only churches that would give proper funerals to the people that perished in the fire, you know. So it's another angle. There's a lot of, the story is really rich and it's really deep and it's really kind of sad and it's not what people think on a lot of levels.
Well, and the priest that was in charge of St. Mark's got a lot of blowback from the parishioners.
He did.
About it. You know, they didn't want him to do it. And he basically wrote a letter back to his congregation that said, this is what we're about, right? If we can't take in people in the community, then we really aren't a community.
And they have a history doing that. I mean, you know, during segregation and integration, I mean, you know, their church was vandalized plenty of times over, you know, Ruby Bridges because Mr. Foreman, who was the minister at the time, his daughter attended the school, and that was as disturbing to the segregationists as anything that a white child and a black child were in school together. They didn't care really that the black child was there. They just didn't want any white children to be there.
Exactly.
As part of the... So we're going to go to the next question. So COVID's been really difficult in New Orleans, and it's been difficult in the Facebook group, and it's, you know, I'm sure it's been difficult on the podcast. How have you managed during COVID? You used to, you know, we do a lot of face-to-face interviews and stuff like that. How have you changed your protocols and all?
So first of all, you're right. Almost all the interviews I had done up until COVID were face-to-face. And in fact, I would turn down most interviews if the person couldn't do it because I just think there's something about the connection. I generally let the guest pick where we're going to do the interview, which is insightful because I get to learn something about them based on what they picked. When you and I did our interview, we did it at Dookie Chase. And then we got to spend a little time with Chef Leah. And that was really important, right? I mean, she played such a role in your life, and she played a pretty decent role in my family's life with the restaurant. COVID caused me to have to do interviews remotely, so I had to change equipment and do that from home. And I really don't love doing it because I think the nonverbal cues are important. I think being sort of out in the wild in New Orleans is important. And I also hit a point last summer where I really debated stopping the podcast because I was down and I was feeling bad for so many people that had it worse off than me, and I just wasn't sure what role the podcast fit. I couldn't really talk about things to do from a tourism point of view. You know, I could focus on the history, but I just really wasn't in a good headspace to do it. And really what kind of spurred me to keep doing it is that you could see in the Facebook group that people really wanted content. They still wanted to know about New Orleans, even if they couldn't visit. So, you know, it's been different. It's also caused me, again, to sort of what we were talking about with the Whitney, kind of go back in history and look at things that appear at first glance to be one thing and maybe are another. And my short example of that is one of the recent episodes I did was about the expressway that was going to be built in the French Quarter. I always believed that that was shot down, and as a result, they built the Claiborne Overpass, which destroyed the culture on Claiborne Avenue. But in fact, that wasn't the case. Both projects were set to go simultaneously, and when the expressway in the French Quarter was canceled, the overpass on Claiborne Avenue was already being built. The downside of that for me about that story is I'm still searching for someone that can talk to me about the history of Claiborne, because I think that's a story that isn't told enough in the mainstream. I think that among the Black community, people understand how devastating it was. But those kind of stories came to the forefront for me with COVID, because it made me think about how are people impacted, not just by a pandemic, but by decisions that are made.
And I think that's a really interesting point, because that was a double whammy of the interstate system and integration. Mm-hmm. Integration helped hollow out the neighborhood too, because, you know, it was kind of an unintended consequence.
Yeah.
You know, no one was forced, you know, to buy. They could buy anywhere. And like,
right.
That was the same thing that happened with Lincoln Beach, that, mm-hmm. you know, and a few other of the...
That's a story I want to tell at some point, Pontchartrain Beach and Lincoln Beach. As I was researching the impact on Claiborne Avenue, there was actually some stuff by Chef Chase. Dookie Chase, of course, was always a sort of hotbed or center point for activism. And I think there was a quote from her that said, it wasn't that we didn't care. We knew the impact, but we were so busy dealing with desegregation and integration that with limited resources, where do you put your energy? And when you think about those two things together, clearly integration and Jim Crow and all of that was much more important. But it came at the cost of... They couldn't spread their energy and the limited money they had in two directions, and so they couldn't fight. You know, there was some opposition, but they couldn't fight the Claiborne Overpass. Not at the same time they're trying to deal with, like you said, Ruby Bridges and the others that helped integrate the school system.
No, that's a it's a really salient point, and that's a whole other conversation. So. I'm going to lighten the mood a little bit. Let me see. Where am I? Oh, so you are born and raised here, and you're raising your family here.
Yeah.
One of the most common questions you get on the Facebook page is about what to do with kids or moving to New Orleans. I mean, you could set up a whole other Facebook page just covering those two questions, but... What's it like raising a family here? You know, what would you tell people about living here, moving here?
So first of all, don't send me the messages. I'm not starting another Facebook group. One is plenty. So I was born and raised. I moved away for 15 years.
Where do you live?
I lived lots of places. Houston, Nashville, St. Paul, 10 years in Northern Virginia. And our children were actually born in Northern Virginia. But when they were 10 weeks old... we moved back to New Orleans, in part because I wanted to raise them as New Orleanians. So it was interesting. It was important to my wife, who's born in Virginia, that they be born in Virginia. And it was important to me that they be raised in New Orleans. Luckily, she had gone to school here, so it was an easy sell. But it gets back to, I knew how rich a childhood I had growing up in the city. My kids take beignets and Mardi Gras and Jazz Fest for granted. Like, it's a birthright to them. They don't see it as, I think they appreciate it, but they don't see it as special, right? They have cousins that live in Atlanta and Houston, or in Dallas, and those kids are so excited when they come, and our kids are like, well, we had beignets last week, and they could give you a top list, right? Beignets and snowballs, they have a top five list of places they like. And I knew that. I knew about kids. I grew up in a parade ladder, right? On St. Charles and Napoleon, enjoying Mardi Gras. And so what I would say is it is a fabulous place to raise kids. You're not spending time on Bourbon Street with kids. You know, you're exploring. Look, we're in the Bywater right now, and 10 feet from us are kids playing cornhole. You know, there's plenty of kids here right now. So it's a really great place to raise a family. It's also a really great place if you don't have a family because there's just so much to do, right? You're never at 3 o'clock today here. There's a really great musician that's going to play. And that's so common, right? Now that music's starting to open up, there's probably 35 places today you could go hear world-class music. And that's just, you know, that's not true everywhere.
And one of the other questions you get all the time is about what neighborhood should I move to? And I've always felt like neighborhoods in New Orleans are like suit jackets. You got to try them on.
Yes.
And then you're going to find the one that fits, but you might not find it right away.
That's, you know, so another plug for Liz Wood. It was really important to me to find a realtor as a sponsor because of that issue, James. This is a hard city to move to and get right the first time. You know, the neighborhoods are so unique and so compact, really, right? I mean, New Orleans is not a big city at all. And it's really hard to get that right when you come in, when you move here, right? You don't know if you want walkability. You don't know. If you're in a place like the Bywater or the Marigny, on the one hand, it's extremely compact and tight, and there's lots of places to walk to, and there's hole-in-the-wall restaurants and bars. There's also traffic coming through from tourists, and you know, it's tucked into a pocket along the river, so it's not the easiest place to get somewhere. Well, you could live uptown, you could live in the Garden District, but it's really expensive and sort of has its own culture that not a lot of people like. You know, you are more of a downtown guy, and I
am definitely a downtown guy.
And there are uptown guys, and mid-city is wonderful along City Park, but it may not be for everyone. Some people really like living. We got a question the other day in the group about a retiree. They might really like living in the Central Business District, where they can live in a high-rise, but that may not be possible financially, or it may not be their deal, right? So I think you're right. I think it's also why Liz often tells people rent for a year. Come figure it out, because you think you know. But if you haven't spent real time here, it's hard to know.
So you mentioned hole-in-the-wall bars and neighborhood restaurants. Talk to me a little bit about Teddy's Grill, the importance of it. I mean, the building's still there.
It is.
It's Fiorella's now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we're both in the restaurant industry at some point in our lives. What was the impact of the restaurant on you, your family, the neighborhood? And people still come and ask you about it, right?
They do. So it was on Franklin Avenue, right near Franklin and Fillmore in Gentilly. It is now Fiorella's. As is so typical in New Orleans, I went to school with Kelsey Fiorella, one of the two brothers, from kindergarten through high school. We knew them for a long time. We've known them all my life.
Was that Brother Martin?
Yeah, it was Brother Martin.
Okay.
And elementary school at St. James. High school is important in New Orleans.
Talk about that before you get into...
So the only other city I know like that is St. Louis. So when people here ask you where you went to school, they don't mean college. They mean high school. And it's good and bad. What it does is it sort of instantly says something about you, and people make a judgment based on your answer, right? At the same time, if you're local and someone says, where'd you go to high school, it's like 2 degrees of separation. Because no matter what you say, that person knows somebody who went there. And so it's really easy to make connections as a local. I think it's a little frustrating sometimes for people that aren't from here. But St. Louis is the only other place I've been that people do that. Teddy's Grill, though, so my dad started working there when he was 14. He bought the place with my mom. They were married when they were 18. When they were 19, they bought the restaurant. They closed on the restaurant January 16th, 1970, I think. And I was born on September 16th, 1970. So I was a celebration baby. They were 19 years old. They had a kid in a restaurant. And they were married. So I can't imagine, right? Cannot imagine. Someday when my kids listen to this, Olivia and Sophia, you cannot get married at 19 or 18. Sorry. But what it meant is I have a brother and a sister, but the restaurant felt like another brother to me. My playpen was there. I grew up there. There are still people that I run into that say they remember me when I was tiny. And they were kids with a kid, and soon they had 3 kids. And so we essentially lived there. I did homework laying on a chest freezer in the back or in the stock room on the 3rd shelf on top of bags of red beans, right? That's where I would do my reading. And it was so integral to our lives.
Did they make you pick through them for rocks? Was
absolutely
that your job?
We used trays like cafeteria lunch trays, and we had to shake the beans, right, to look for rocks. We got our beans from Camellia, so they very rarely had rocks.
Of course. You know, I found a rock. And the first time I ever found a rock was last week. And I, you know, picked through them. And I'm like, well, they're not lying. Pick through them. They say it right on the
bag. They tell you. Pick through them. So you very rarely get a rock in Camellia red beans, but you do. That was one of my earliest jobs. You know, I can still hear the sound of shaking red beans in a plastic tray. 25 or 50-pound sacks, right, and going through tons of them. But for me, that was New Orleans. I grew up with the people that worked there. People would come in, both famous and not famous. We had a lot of people. Gentilly at that time had a lot of people who were elderly and had lived in that neighborhood forever, and then eventually their kids bought the houses. And we had people that would come in 4 or 5 days a week. You know, we were their dining room. And they watched me grow up, and I got to know them. And it was hard in hindsight, in the sense of I started working when I was 11, and there were expectations.
And that's hard work, too.
Yeah, it's hard work. You and I have talked about that. Being in a restaurant is, you know, you're on your feet. There's a rush at lunch. There's a rush at dinner. There's always cleaning to be done. And my dad ran a very clean kitchen.
Something always breaks.
Always. And, you know, we were not ever hurting for anything, but we were not well off by any means. So, you know, you run a restaurant, you are living paycheck to paycheck, or certainly close to that, and the employees that work with you are running into that. And, you know, it was incredibly interesting as a kid. I learned business at a very young age because I didn't know any better. We just got to see the rhythm of the neighborhood. You know, people would come in. One story that sticks with me is Michelle McRaney, who has been the chef at Mr. B's for 20 years, I think. Like most chefs, you can relate, she was working 6 days a week. So her husband and their young child would come into the restaurant for dinner almost every night she was working. And over time, we watched him grow from a toddler to a teenager, to the point where he would come in and go behind the counter and make his own sandwich. And, you know, we watched plenty of families grow up like that, and we grew up with them. And so when Katrina hit and the restaurant was destroyed, it felt like losing a sibling.
You were in D.C. at the time?
I was in D.C. And as soon as we could come back, my brother and sister and I all came back to take my parents there. Their home was also against the... So the London Avenue canal was
right.
One that broke. It broke on both sides. Our home backed up against one side, about 10 houses from the break. And the restaurant was about a mile from the other side. So in one day, my parents lost their entire livelihood and their home. Now, they were fortunate in that they had kids in other parts of the country who had, you know, we had all done okay, so we could help them. And they were able to sort of travel for months. When we came home, we took them, the first day we could come back in October, we all came in town, we took them in. It was really hard to see the house, but it was harder to see the restaurant. And then we had to muck it out and literally take apart our life, you know, everything from the freezers to the steam tables to the pictures,
whatever food was left in the
I'll never forget, James, there was a reach-in cooler and it had toppled over, and it just happened to be me that opened the door. So I'm standing on top of it, opened the door, and the worst smell I have ever smelled came out, and we thought it was meatballs that we had made, and it turns out it was lemons that were so rotted that they looked like meatballs. And I can smell that smell now. It's the most disgusting smell I've ever smelled. But there was this whole... We have a family picture standing there in our sort of protective gear after we had gutted the restaurant. And it was such a sad... We then went and did the house, which was terrible. I mean, they lost everything. They lost, you know... But I think we all agree the restaurant was harder, because it just had so many memories, not only for us, but for generations of people that had come, you know, that were essentially part of our extended family.
And, you know, you hear these stories, and it's always interesting to me, because one of your previous guests, who's also a friend of mine, Ted Jackson, talked about how he paddled from the Times-Picayune building, because he lived on the North Shore, to the base of the causeway, and then fell asleep. And he was asleep for hours. Yeah. And then a Coast Guard helicopter picked him up at some point, and he photographed for the Times-Picayune. He's a professional photographer,
right.
You know, the scene. And everybody's sense of loss, and there's just different memories. Like, anyone that lived through 9/11 in the New York City area can tell you what the weather was like. Mm. they'll tell you it was the most gorgeous day of the year. I mean, when I tell you, if there had been a cloud in the sky or it was raining, they might not have been able to see where they were going, you know. But it was the most beautiful, beautiful. And every time when the weather is really nice, it just pops into my head. It's like one of the first things I think about because, you know, I was living there at the time. And I'm sure there's triggers for, you know, you too with
You know, it was interesting with Katrina. We came back, I think the first day you could come back legally was October 6th. And the first thing was, it was incredibly hot. As you know, October can be like sort of this glorious month, or it can still be really hot in New Orleans. And it was in the 90s. And which, a couple things. As we came into the city, it was incredibly quiet. So there were no squirrels, there were no birds, there was no traffic. It was eerie how quiet the city was. And the second thing is, everything below the waterline was gray. And so you and I are sitting next to a hedge. It was just gray from the waterline down. And that was the most bizarre thing.
I think water is a generous statement there. I think there was a lot of other things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. it was not pretty. But I'll never forget, like, you could, it was just gray and quiet and the heat. And so those three things just stick with me. And then the fourth is the smell. When we came back, there was just a stench in the city. There were still lots of dead animals around. You know, it was just a quiet, eerie, sort of disgusting. And the quietness was probably the most disturbing thing. The restaurant was on Franklin Avenue, which was a very busy spot. And we were there for days and never saw a car, you know, other than like the Red Cross would come by with food and that kind of stuff. But, and in some ways, that's never recovered there. So that neighborhood is really one of the most affordable remaining neighborhoods.
And it's a great neighborhood.
It is a great neighborhood.
It's a wonderful neighborhood.
In fact, we had a question this morning about someone in the group just moved to Gentilly. But it doesn't have 20%, 30% of the traffic it had at the time.
So depending on who you ask, post-Katrina New Orleans is better, worse, different. What's your take on it?
This is going to seem like a hedge, but I think better and worse. And the worst part is you had businesses like mine, you had families like you mentioned earlier that had been here for generations, had been in their neighborhoods, and a lot of that got lost. A lot of businesses like Teddy's Grill didn't come back. The good is this... go ahead.
No, and we're seeing the same thing with COVID. A lot of businesses...
Again, absolutely, right? The good is that influx of people. And I know, like, again, you and I have talked about this offline, that there is this divide between native-born, like, you know, New Orleanians who were born here and New Orleanians who are newer. And there's, you know, sometimes... I think that's BS. I feel like if you are engaged in the culture and you live here, you're a New Orleanian. But this influx of people, again, back to the Central American influence, it is so rich here. Before Katrina, the only place I can think of that was sort of a Mexican, true Mexican place was Taqueria Corona.
Out in...
On Magazine Street.
Oh, okay, right.
So it's uptown, so, you know, it's far for you. But
very, very far.
My wife and I ate there last night. But since
this is like a Dean Martin roast, all of a sudden,
right? It's all about you. I mean, you know, I'm used to being the host, James. But you know, there's this influx of Latin cuisine and authentic Mexican cuisine. You think about, you mentioned earlier, sort of mofo with this combination of Vietnamese and
that's
Cajun
Michael
Creole, right?
He's a very good chef. Very
and Maypop.
M-A-pop.
So I think that richness, that refreshing, I do feel like, I think I said earlier, New Orleans to me felt stagnant, and it doesn't feel stagnant anymore. There are challenges, gentrification and housing prices, Lord knows, have gone up, and you overlay that with the never-ending political corruption and the you pay taxes and you still drive through potholes and screw up your car and, you know, all that stuff. But it is a more vibrant town than it was before Katrina. By far, it's more vibrant. And this influx of people that came and helped and decided to make it a home, we're better for that.
One of the most popular questions, besides moving to New Orleans, is about Mardi Gras. Mm-hmm. Tell me what Mardi Gras means to you personally and what it means to the city.
For me, it's about family and friends. There are, for many years, we went, in fact, right by Polly Watt's place, Avenue Pub. It used to be called Dick's Bar. In fact, Polly was on the show a couple weeks ago. We went there every Mardi Gras. And there were people we would see there that we only saw in Mardi Gras. And that's an area you're not far from the heart of the Garden District. So really nice houses, really wealthy families. And it always struck me in hindsight that you would have us from a middle-class neighborhood in Gentilly. You'd have people from the Garden District, extremely wealthy. You'd have people from Central City nearby. But on that day, none of that mattered. You're in the street, sharing chicken, sharing a beer, watching out for each other's kids. And I really think that's core to New Orleans, because for all the problems we have, and we have a lot of them, that day, you're all common. You're all begging for throws, you're sharing food, you're watching each other's kids.
I think one of the things about this city, in a world where we increasingly just like kind of talk to ourselves, or talk, you know, we're on our phones, we're mm-hmm. we have our headphones in, we're kind of, it's like a form of solipsism almost. New Orleans still does community really well. You know, French Quarter Fest, Jazz Fest, mm-hmm. Mardi Gras. We have so many events that basically force you to be next to people that don't look like you, that don't mm-hmm. think like you, that don't act like you.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the last places on earth.
I think that's a core, right? I mean, I believe it all stems from Mardi Gras, because if you've spent enough time here, you've grown up here, you're used to that, right? So to me today, what Mardi Gras means is what it meant when I was a kid. We're just outgrowing parade ladders. So, you know, for people that are listening, this is going to sound worse than it is, but it's a 6-foot aluminum ladder.
It's pretty bad.
It's not bad. It's
bad.
6-foot aluminum ladder. You build a 3-foot wide plywood box. You put a dowel across the front and you put your children in it. It's really not that bad.
It sounds safe.
As long as an adult is standing on the back. But that's the way that I experience Mardi Gras. And the idea is the kids are up above and you got a dad usually behind them. The downside is they get smacked in the face with beads. But, you know, that's part of carnival.
It's part what, yeah.
And so my kids are 9 now, so they've outgrown the parade ladder. But they have grown up like we have. We see people on Mardi Gras Day that we only see on Mardi Gras Day. And it's by virtue of the fact that we go to the same corner. And there's a part of that that is just so important, I think. Your point about the other festivals is right, too. There's so many festivals. Most of them are free. Most of them are accessible. You know, Jazz Fest is relatively expensive, so I get that. But there are festivals where you go, and where you work or where you live or how much money you make don't matter.
I want to actually defend Jazz Fest here, because I think if you just wanted to go see Elton John, you'd pay $100 just to see Elton John.
Yes.
For $80 or whatever, Jazz, even if it's $100 a day, you get there.
You get 10 hours of music,
you get
right?
At least 8 hours of music, plus some of the best food you'll ever have.
I still think it's a deal, but I get that $75, $80, $85 is out of reach for some people, right?
I agree.
I don't think it's a bad, I think it's a good value. But I also get that not everyone can do it.
And I agree, and I think there's probably should be more programs for locals to have access, especially, you know, kids. I think, you know, it's got to be a fun day for a kid.
And they do. I know they do a lot with schools to offer kids, like, a field trip, right, where there's no cost. Of course, you can see most, minus the national acts, you can see most of the same acts at French Quarter Fest for free, right? So almost every local New Orleans act performs at both of them. Yeah, the Elton Johns, the Pearl Jams, whatever. You're not going to see those at French Quarter Fest, because French Quarter Fest is 99% focused on New Orleans and the other 1% is Louisiana. But almost every festival is free. You know, all the things in Lafayette Square, the stuff along Waldemar Park, you know, they're free or very cheap. And I think that gets back to your original point about there are opportunities for all the differences and all the problems in New Orleans. People are coming together to enjoy good food and good music. You know, and it's a very much class-leveling experience. You know, you're standing or sitting in a bag chair next to someone who could be in a far different socioeconomic position than you, or culturally very different. And not much brings people together more than good food. You know, and you add music on top of that, and world-class music on top of that. I think it's just I just think it's a great leveler and a great, it's community, right? I mean, New Orleans is so much about community.
Okay, so we're going to bring it back to the podcast. Who are your favorite guests, guests that you would love to have on in the future, and the ones that got away?
So the one that got away was Chef Leah Chase. I was scheduled to interview her a week after she died. And her daughter, Stella, called me about 10 days before she passed and said, look, it's just not going to happen. And, you know, I certainly didn't know her super well, but I knew her well enough that when I went in, she would reminisce about my dad's fried chicken.
She remembered everything.
She did. That's true. She remembered if she met you once, she knew something about you. That's the one that got away. The second was probably Alan Toussaint, who we had a little bit of a relationship with. He ate in the restaurant a lot. He and I at one point lived around the corner from each other.
What was his favorite dish?
Stewed chicken. So on Wednesdays, we made stewed chicken with macaroni and cheese with brown gravy on top. And he would always come. So he drove a two-tone brown Rolls Royce.
He did.
And he would show up and very quiet and unassuming. And, you know, every once in a while, somebody would walk up to him. But he always came in for stewed chicken on Wednesdays. So those are probably the two that I've missed. It's hard to say favorite. So the easy answer is my dad. I interviewed my dad, I think, in episode 6 about the history of the po' boy. And that was selfish. You know, I wanted my dad to tell his story in a way that he wasn't going to be nervous. And also, I wanted to, and they listen to every episode, so Dad, don't get too choked up when I say this. They listen to, by the way, they listen to every episode, and many of them I get a critique from my mom. Like, this was really good, you missed this, you should do this, whatever. I love you, Mom. But I really enjoy getting to document that with my dad, and as much as anything for my kids, that we have Grandpa's voice and his story. And, in, you know, today we all have 20,000 pictures on our phones, but we don't capture audio very much, and so we have him captured. I need to interview my mom. I need to do that sooner than later. I think people I still want to interview, I want to interview Irma Thomas, and there's no reason I haven't. Like, I need to just reach out. She would clearly do it.
She's so nice.
Yes. She would, you know, I just need to make that happen. This one's going to surprise people, but I want to interview Jimmy Buffett. And the reason I want to interview Jimmy Buffett is he grew up in Pascagoula, Mississippi, along the Gulf Coast. But he was a teacher. But he started his music career busking in the French Quarter. And I am sure Jimmy Buffett's been interviewed hundreds, if not thousands, of times. But I doubt very many people have. The focus I want is to talk to him about his New Orleans time. Every once in a while at Jazz Fest, and he frequently performs, he'll mention New Orleans. But I don't want to interview him about Margaritaville and Parrot Heads and all that. I'm really interested in his New Orleans experience as a street busker. And so, you know, that would surprise people. But that's one I still want to do. I think it's achievable. I almost had it set up a year ago, and then COVID hit. And then the others are not. I want to continue to interview people that have interesting stories. I want to do more about Claiborne Avenue.
You mentioned Ruby Bridges to me.
Yeah. There's no reason I haven't done that, right? She lives, I don't know if she lives here in California, but she's certainly accessible.
Leona Tate.
Yep. I want to interview, and I know you can set this up. I want to interview, now I'm drawing a blank, Baby Dolls.
You be careful with the Baby Dolls.
I'm drawing a blank. Desiree.
Oh, okay.
I'm drawing a blank on her last name. Is it Destrahan?
Oh, Diane. Diane Henry.
Diane Henry. Right. You know, if there's a thing I feel like I haven't done enough, I try to have diversity in the podcast, but I think I'm constantly striving for that. Like, it's not as diverse as I want. You know, I think that so much of New Orleans culture is in the Black community. And look, I'm proud of I've done a lot of that, but I don't think I've done as much as I want. You know, so I'll keep working on that.
Sometimes it's difficult to find authoritative voices because there's so many aspects of it. Like, if you interview different baby dolls, you're going to get different stories about, and they're all true.
Right.
But, you know, the idea there's one representative story sometimes is not necessarily true.
There's also some trust issues because so often, particularly reporters or journalists come from out of town. And people feel betrayed in the stories they've told. Two that come to mind, I talked to Sylvester Francis, who's now passed. He was the founder and the real heart behind the Backstreet Cultural Museum. And we spent an afternoon swinging on the front porch swing at the museum. And I couldn't interview him on... I couldn't record him because he had an agreement with Spike Lee and HBO to tell the story that never got told. But he couldn't do that. And the second was Mr. Ronald Lewis, really close to where you live, right?
Very nice man.
The House of Dance and Feathers.
Also the founder of the Big Nine Soul Shade and Pleasure Club.
Yep.
You know, which was really, besides House of Dance and Feathers, that was his passion. He used to be out. Yep. He loved the second line. And then North Side Skull and Bones Gang.
Yeah, he was very involved there, right? Sumpai Barnes is another one I need to talk to. But the... So he wouldn't let me record him because he was really distrustful because a couple months before he had been interviewed by a journalist from a big publication and he felt like they didn't tell the story well. And at the time, I think I had done 10 episodes, 12 episodes. We had a great conversation, and when we finished, he said, I wish I had let you record it. But I think that was episode 13 about Mardi Gras Indians, and I just had to piece it together as best I could. But so there's a balance, right, of trying. Now, I think 5 years in, I know enough people that can make introductions to sort of take that wariness away, and I feel confident enough that someone who's a little dubious could listen to a past episode or someone could vouch for me. But that's something I think I want to continue to work on, is just trying to get diverse voices on the podcast.
I have two more for you, and I'm not actually sure the order I want to ask them in, so let me...
I'll keep sipping my beer while you figure that out.
Yeah, we're getting low.
Yeah, we are.
What do you see for the podcast, and where would you like to see it go in the future?
I have wrestled with that in COVID. I was very much intent on sort of building the business end of that and getting more sponsors and doing some different offshoots. I'm writing a travel guide.
I wanted to, you know, so that we'll was my third question. So do you want to talk about the book a little bit?
I'll come back to it.
Okay.
Because I get so much feedback that people enjoy the show and feel a connection to New Orleans. But one of the things that has hit me during COVID is that I'm sort of taking a little bit of a step back and getting back to sort of where I started 5 years ago, which is doing the things I enjoy with the podcast, and not worrying so much about growing it as a business as kind of... just touching the things that I'm passionate about and sharing people's stories that I think don't get told enough. And again, just kind of stepping back from the profit side of it and just telling stories for a while. I'm fortunate enough to have a day job. And while I would love the podcast to be my full-time job, I feel like I'm so thankful that my family has come through COVID healthy and financially okay and having health insurance and all those things that people don't take for granted, that I think it has just caused me to say, let me just take a deep breath and tell stories about New Orleans and not worry about anything else. In terms of the book, a couple years ago I signed a contract to write a book for a national publisher, Globe Pequot. They are a subset of a really big publishing company, and I was really excited. So we're working on the Beyond Bourbon Street Travel Guide to New Orleans. Unfortunately, my timing could not be worse, James. To try to write a travel book during a pandemic is a really hard thing to do. So I've written the first draft. I wrote the whole book, then had to rewrite the whole book. I just submitted, so it should have been out last fall. Now it'll come out in December of 2021, but I basically had to rewrite it because so many businesses closed.
So many.
And now we're in the spot of we're going to have to edit it right up till it gets printed because businesses are closing all the time.
Avery's closed the other day.
Yeah. And a couple businesses are closed and are now trying to come back. But you're right. Businesses are closing all the time. And it's really hard. You can't talk about hours. You can't talk about necessarily the food that they offer because places have modified schedules. They've slimmed down menus. You know, music until last week, was really closed. And I'm not an author. So that was a really...
So talk about that a little bit. What's the process like? I mean, you've never written a book before.
No,
what's
and I never wanted to write a book. It's been fumbling around. I am lucky that I know several authors. I know several New Orleanians who have written books. Richard Campanella, Sally Asher, Elizabeth Pierce, Bobby Fiesler, Maurice Carlos Ruffin. But I didn't know what I was doing. And so this being New Orleans, people are recognizing us as we're sitting here. I really didn't know what I was doing. And I'm not sure I still know. The best advice I've gotten, and this seems so simplistic, I think it's true for all writers, is the most important thing is just to write. To sit down and just write, even if you don't know where you're going with it. It's been hard. And the other thing, I think I told you this the other day. At some point in the process, I got a serious case of imposter syndrome because I realized that I'm writing the book for people who want to visit, right? But all of my friends who have their own New Orleans experiences, no matter what I write, are going to say, well, why didn't you include this? And why did you do that? And right? I'm thinking of you and other people who will be good-natured about it, but everybody's got their own view of New Orleans. And so that really became a barrier. It was like almost paralyzed. I'm like, no matter what I write, somebody's going to have an opinion. And that's just the nature of it, right? So sort of what I've come around to is write your own book. You know, if you don't agree, write your own book. I'm really excited to... So now the first draft is with the editor, Amy Lyons, my terrific editor. And I'm excited to see it come out because I think that for the people that don't live here, it can help them experience New Orleans in a different way. And even if it's maybe not the way you would say it, all I want is to open their eyes to get two blocks off of Bourbon Street.
Absolutely. You know. And I mean, this is something, it's not a one and done. You can always update it. You can always evolve it. You know, it can become like a series, honestly.
Yep. And we've talked about that. The editor and I, and I also think it'll be a jumping off point for podcast. I think I'll come up with plenty of other topics. I think it'll probably, in many ways, a book becomes a business card, so it opens some doors, you know, to other people I might want to interview. It's been hard, though. If I had known how hard it was going to be, I would have said no. Now that I have the first draft in Amy's hands, I feel better about it. You know, and I'm excited to see what people think of it. And, you know, in the Facebook group, when someone says, we just went to New Orleans and we had the best time because either the podcast or people local like you and me that are able to answer questions, that is so gratifying. Because like you said, it is really easy to come to New Orleans and have a bad time. Spend 3 nights on Bourbon Street, get ridiculously sick off of hand grenades.
Get robbed once.
Right. It's really easy to have a bad experience. And if the book, if the podcast, if the people in the community can help people have a better experience, that's worth it to me.
And I mean, part of that bad experience, too, is not just what happens to you personally, but your perception of what this place is. And
yes.
I think that's because they're going to go home and like, yeah, I went to New Orleans. It was like going to Panama Beach or, you know, like...
Exactly.
I mean, just...
And you can have such a different experience, right? With just a couple
such
of pointers
a richer experience.
From somebody local.
Last question. So, in an interview I did with you previously for Very Local NOLA, you told me you went to, I think it was Texas, to learn how to do a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And you paid for it, and your wife told you, you better come home with a podcast.
Right.
It's been a long journey since then. What's... What have you learned, and what's the most surprising thing about this whole venture beyond Bourbon Street?
So what you're referring to is, I think in 2014, there's a podcast conference called Podcast Movement.
That's it.
And on 2 days' notice, I actually had arm surgery, so I had a cast. And on 2 days' notice, my wife said, look, there's this podcast conference in Fort Worth. I think you should go. And her only requirement was, although she remembers it a little differently, if you go and we spend the money and you go at the last minute, you better come home with a podcast. And so I went. I'm very introverted, although people don't believe it. And I walked around with a couple ideas. And every time someone introduced me to someone and I mentioned the ideas, people lit up when I talked about New Orleans. So I came home and said, okay, I'm going to do it. It took about 8 months before I actually did it. I think, gosh, one of the things that has really hit me is how personal podcasting is. And what I mean by that is, when you listen to my podcast or any podcast, it's a pretty intimate experience. You know, often you're in your car or you have earbuds in and you are allowing me physically to be very close to you, and you are taking, you know, there's lots of distractions in this world, phones and internet and television and Netflix. But when you choose to listen to a podcast, you're giving that podcaster your attention, and that comes with some responsibility. But it comes with this intimacy that I really get to dive in and share with you a view. And what I really like is, if you don't like my voice, you don't listen. If you don't like New Orleans, you don't listen. If you don't think I'm interesting, you don't listen. But if you get beyond those things, you become deeply engrossed in it. So people that decide I'm okay and the topic's okay and they like New Orleans, they're passionate. You know, they've jumped through these hoops. So it is a very engaged group. And when I get an email or a text that says, I listened to this episode and it really changed my perspective, or I didn't know that, that is really gratifying. And when I started, I wasn't sure anybody besides my mom would listen. I wasn't even sure my dad would listen. But I knew, you know, I thought my mom would listen. And now you jump forward and I meet people all over the place, and you're waving to people behind us and people are walking up, and, you know, I'm out getting ice cream with the kids, and someone walks up and says, you know, are you Mark Bologna and are these your kids, and you have made our vacation so much different. Or a local says, I would have never thought to go do that. People that have been here a long time are scared to come to the Marigny and the Bywater because they have this perspective of what it was like 20, 30 years ago, and it's not that. And I had no idea that would happen, and it's been extremely gratifying to open people's eyes to a local's view of New Orleans.
So you have anything else for me?
Yeah, I do, actually.
All right.
So I want people to know who you are and where they can find it. You are a photographer, a fabulous photographer, and the thing I like about your work is that you really capture, you have a way of capturing people's expressions and the moments. I think where you shine is people, as opposed to sort of static things. First of all, where can people find your photography?
Okay, so on Instagram, I'm Accidental Cajun. That's where you get it for free. If you'd like to pay for it, my website is theaccidentalcajun.com, and that's a mix of fine art, journalism. I don't sell all my things. Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to cultural photography, if there's a photo of a, you know, Black Masking Indian, Mardi Gras Indian on my site, I have an agreement with them that we split the profits 50-50. So that's, you know, my standing rule. Otherwise, you know, I don't sell it. My photojournalism, depending on what it is, I don't necessarily sell it. But everything else is, you know, for sale. And I like to think I shoot a little differently. I mean, you know, everybody. But, you know, I enjoy people, in the abstract at least. I mean, but, you know, I think one of the things about being, I'm very fortunate. When we talked earlier about New Orleans and kind of the stratification of you didn't leave your neighborhood. Mm. Me not being from here, I don't have any of those kind of constraints. I can go to any neighborhood, and I have. I remember, you know, one time after a second line, I jumped into a car with a guy named Milton Boo Carr, he's a tour guide here. And Milton's like, we're going to go find some Indians to practice. I'm like, okay. You know, we had a few drinks on it, so we go uptown. We go in this bar, there's no Indians. I'm like, Milton, I'm like, you know where you're going? He's like, yeah, kind of. We finally end up with some, you know, Indians, and I'm thinking, I just jumped in the car with this guy, you know, because on a whim, you know.
Right.
And then he drove me home. I mean, when I first moved to New Orleans, I went to his second line. And I followed it, and I followed it, and I followed it, and ended up way uptown at Taps 2, which is, you know, a very local New Orleans black bar, honestly. You know, behind St. Joseph's Cemetery, kind of over. And I remember being outside, and kind of getting dark, and I'm looking around, and I don't know where I am. I just moved here, you know, a few weeks ago. And an older gentleman goes, "White boy." And I'm looking around. He's like, "You see any other white boy?" I'm like, "No." He's like, "Come in the bar." And it ended up being one of the Paulin brothers from the Paulin Brothers band. And we shoot pool. We're drinking some beers. We're having conversations. He's like, "Ah, come on. I'll give you a ride home." So, and this is totally off topic of my photography, but it's a good story, and I want to tell it. So we're driving, and he pulls off behind a cemetery. And I'm like, "Well, this isn't where I'm staying." So he goes, "Get out." And I'm like, "Oh, boy, this is not going well." So I get out of the car because I really don't have an option at this point. And we walk up to this little shotgun house, and it has a plaque on it. And it's a plaque dedicated to his great-grandfather. And he wanted to show me the house and see the plaque and meet his family. And then we got back in the car, and he drove me home. And, you know, it's just one of those kind of things. New Orleans, has you got to be on faith here. There's a lot of things that happen based on trust and faith. And it can go very right or very wrong, depending. But you know, I don't really talk about my culinary very often, but I feel like now's the time. You know, recently I became the chef of Little Dizzy's Cafe. I helped the Baquet family reopen it. You know, we're open 6 days a week currently from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. for lunch. So come down. You know, it's the Baquets, like the Chase family, are one of the really big New Orleans Creole restaurant families, and it's really been interesting for me because the more I learn about Creole cooking, the more I learn it's very similar to Sicilian cooking. And, you know, in the history of New Orleans cooking, you know, like your family, white people, black people, they all kind of cooked in this this, you know, métier, this milieu. So it was so I've been doing that, you know. I did a little wedding photography. I shot my fourth wedding of the year last night. So but you know, primarily I've been very fortunate to have really good access to the culture, but it's been relationships I've built over years and years and years. You know, I mean, you are right, people are naturally and rightly a little distrustful of you sometimes, but you just gotta kind of, if I could give advice to someone that was coming here or moving here, is just be genuine. I think New Orleanians have a very good sense of when people are being real and when they're putting on. And, you know, and also just be respectful. You know, I understand the impetus, like when you see Indians or dolls or other aspects of like the cultural community to kind of like want to bum rush it, but you kind of got to, you know, give them the space and respect and the, you know, the deference they deserve, I think, is
well, and I think that's one of the things that makes your photography unique. You really, you capture faces and expressions really well, in my opinion, particularly in the black community. And part of that is because they know you, right? So when you walk up with a camera, they're seeing a friend. As opposed to, there is a lot of, like, it's wonderful. And if you're visiting and there's a second line or you're here for Super Sunday, you should go out and see the Indians. But people show up with these big cameras and get in the face of Indians, and they don't, you know, they'll take the pictures, but they don't know you. And I think you get those expressions because people know you.
It's to some degree, but part of it's understanding the cadence and the rhythm of what's happening. Like, if you shoot enough Indians or go to Indian practice or go to... There is, it's like a dance. You know, I kind of bring everything back to the kitchen because for me, everything is about timing and rhythm and, you know, like sixth sense. And like, part of the reason I capture expressions is because I know what's going to happen next. Like, I know what the next thing that's going to come is just from, like, no one thinks I'm introverted, but I really am in the sense that I like to participate, but I really like to observe. And, you know, by observing and documenting, you kind of get the sense of, you know, what the next move is. And when you shoot, especially like journalistic photography or street photography, you kind of have to think about three steps ahead of the shot you want, like where they're going to be in like a minute from, or 30 seconds or 10 seconds, then, because by the time you pull it up, you're going to miss that moment. So you have to kind of anticipate what the shot you want is. And it's interesting. It's difficult. Photography is ubiquitous these days. Everybody has a camera.
Sure.
You know, it's you carry one around with you.
Right.
But good photography, you know, I felt like there's a lot of like older film photographers that bemoan like, everyone can be a photographer. Well, it's true. But in the past, you had to have a lot more technical knowledge about how the thing works, but you didn't necessarily have to have more talent. I feel like to stand out these days, because everyone can do it, you have to be a lot more interesting, you know? And
Well, you and I have talked about our friend Ted Jackson, right? Who is a guest on the show.
Phenomenal photographer.
And the difference is, right, we all have an iPhone or whatever in our pocket and can take a picture, but that's not the same as the art of photography, right? And perspective and framing and understanding how to compose an image. And so that's different. The other thing I wanted to mention, well, two things. One, you kind of gloss by it, but one of the things that makes you unique with your photography is this, you really care about the culture and about ensuring that the culture bearers get credit and get finance, right? So this idea when you take pictures of Indians that you share, that's not common, and that plays a big role in their lives. The other thing is, and I know you... you might not mention it, but you also are on Patreon, so people can support you and get some of your writing that you can't see elsewhere. So if they want to find you on Patreon, is it Patreon.com/AccidentalCajun?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is.
I think it is, and I'll put a link to it.
If you search my name, right, you know, James Cullen, C-U-L-L-E-N, it comes up. But, the culture is very important to me, and I always try to represent it in as positive a light as possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if you study the history of Black Medicine culture, I mean, it hasn't always gotten the same respect in the city that it has today. For years, you know, the city's tried to kind of shut it down or control it or police it. And even, you know, last week, I was under the Claiborne Bridge on St. Joseph's Night, and there were police officers. I mean, you would have thought, you know, like there was a riot about to take place. They were lined up underneath, but the same policing wasn't in the French Quarter.
Right.
You know, the tourists were allowed to walk up and down the street, you know, unabated. And, you know, if I have any issue with the city, I think, you know, we do too much for people that don't live here, not enough to promote and protect the culture that is here. We profit off it, and I think we exploit it to some degree, but we don't necessarily protect it. Throughout the pandemic, I'm like, what are we doing for these musicians? What are we doing for these Indians? And, you know, I don't think there was really any satisfactory response.
Well, and probably the best example of that right now is there have been numerous bars and entities that are packed. And Kermit Ruffin's Mother-in-Law Lounge got shut down for like the third time. And he's trying to follow So he's right on Claiborne Avenue. Kermit is an institution. The Mother-in-Law Lounge, which was owned by Ernie Cato before Kermit, is an institution. Kermit has tried to do everything right that he can. And he has an outdoor patio so people can, you know. And he got shut down for seemingly a minor violation. And he is one of the prominent, preeminent culture bearers in the city.
I agree. You know, I know Kermit personally. And... you know, I won't say everyone's trying their best.
Yes.
You know, and if anyone should be cut a little slack or given a little leeway, I feel Kermit Ruffin should be given a little leeway. You know, it's not just, you know, him as a musician or him as a bar owner, but him as, you know, a community member and humanitarian. Throughout this pandemic, Kermit Ruffins has been feeding people.
Yeah.
He's been clothing people. He's been doing a lot. And to see kind of like the antagonistic relationship that the city has with him right now, it's kind of heartbreaking on some level.
It is.
Because I don't really understand it. You know, and I also think he's getting blamed for, you know, Claiborne Avenue is a cultural conduit, and all sorts of things happen on Sundays, especially Sundays. You know, there's second lines, there's, you know, parties under the bridge, there's food vendors, there's people detailing cars, there's any kind of commerce. It's like a marketplace. Any kind of commerce or party or whatever you can imagine,
and
it's kind of happening
guilty
there.
Guilty by proximity.
And, I mean, but, you know, I mean, so is Sydney Torres, and no one's shutting down Circle Food, you know, but...
Yeah. Very good.
And I kind of feel like maybe his neighbors complain, you know. I don't know that for a fact, but, you know, I'm just saying that when I saw the drainage project finally get completed in front of Circle Food, you know, years Circle Food was a black-owned business, and Sydney Torres bought it, and all of a sudden they completed the drainage project, they repaved it. So I feel there's some political pull. And
I think that's a good...
I can't prove it, but...
That's a good kind of full circle, right, about the... tensions and pulls in the city. And you know, we started off early on talking about Claiborne Avenue, and it comes full circle there. You know, I just want to say thank you. I was leery about doing this, but I can't think of a better person to turn the microphone over, so thank you, James, for doing this.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed this, and I think, you know, as I was listening to you speak, I'm like, I think this is a really interesting and good podcast. You know, I thought you were a really great guest, and you know, I have some experience doing this, not a lot, but I think your listeners are really going to enjoy this.
Well, I hope so.
Me too.
You can't have the podcast.
I don't want it.
Thank you. Once again, you can support me and James on Patreon, and we'll put links to both on the show notes. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you love New Orleans as much as we do, please share it with somebody else who shares that passion. And until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.